Could the autism epidemic be an optical illusion? Steve Silberman will be here to talk about his book, Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity.
Autism parenting has a long and terrible history of people being subjected to shame and stigma, because for most of the 20th century, the prevailing theory among psychologists was that autism was caused by bad parenting.
What happens when a woman with a perfect work-life balance gets a more than full-time job at a 24/7 tech company? Elizabeth Egan will be here to talk about her debut novel, A Window Opens.
The thing that keeps me up at night the most is the pull between family and ambition and family and finances and trying to find the right footing in both of those worlds.
Looking for that perfect picture book? Maria Russo, our children's book editor, will join us to talk about this year's back-to-school kids books. Alexander Alter will fill us in on the latest from the literary world. Carl Sagal has bestseller news. And we'll let readers and listeners ask a few questions for us editors here at the Book Review. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Steve Silberman joins me now from San Francisco. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Pamela. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. Your new book is called Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. A very interesting subject, but not one that you would think someone who writes about science and cultural affairs for Wired, you write a lot about technology as well, would necessarily write about. So what brought you to this topic?
Yes, I came to the subject of autism in a very interesting and very Wired way. Back in, I believe it was 2000, I was on a boat with over 100 computer programmers cruising through Alaska on something called a geek cruise. And there was a guy in the boat who invented one of the first open source programming languages called Perl, without which things like Amazon and Craigslist and the Internet Movie Database that we all depend on would not be possible. And towards the end of the cruise, I asked him if I could come and interview him at home in Silicon Valley. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, I have an autistic daughter. And at that point, like most people at the time who didn't have a personal connection to autism, I didn't know that much about it, really beyond what I'd seen in Rain Man. His remark registered, but I didn't think anything of it. But then a few months later, I was profiling another technologically very adept family in Silicon Valley. In fact, the patriarch of the family built the first computer in the Middle East. And I asked the sister-in-law of the woman I was profiling if I could come interview her at home. And she said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And I thought, well, that's an odd, you know, coincidence. And at that point, like most of the world, I believed that autism was this extremely rare, neurological syndrome. And so I was telling that story to a friend of mine in the neighborhood cafe here in San Francisco. A woman at the next table said, oh, my God, do you realize what's happening? I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so I got a chill, and I also, because I'm a reporter, I got the desire to do some reporting. And so I wrote an article in 2001 for Wired called The Geek Syndrome, which was one of the first mainstream articles to look at, to take seriously the notion that there were a lot of people with autistic traits working in high-tech communities. So I wrote the article, and what happened was, for years afterwards, I got letters, well, emails anyway, I got emails and from all different types of people, from autistic people who saw reflections of themselves in my story, from parents who lived in high-tech communities. I remember I got an email from a dentist who worked in a town where there was a big IBM shop, and he said that many of the parents who worked at IBM had autistic children. And what the world was arguing about at that point, so we're talking the mid-2000s, the world was having a long and very rancorous argument about whether or not vaccines cause autism, promoted by the fraudulent paper of Andrew Wakefield. But this is not what the parents that I had written about and the parents that were writing me were concerned about by that point. What they were facing was that their kids would, quote-unquote, age out of services once they graduated high school. And so they were no longer, you know, kind of obsessing about what had caused their child's autism. They were really facing difficult challenges helping their kids transition out of school, helping their kids find jobs, helping their kids learn how to live independently in the community. And I realized that while this long argument about vaccines was unfolding in the mainstream world, that the parents of autistic kids and also autistic adults were dealing with a completely different set of challenges that we were not meeting as a society. By focusing so narrowly on the dynamics of autism in high-tech communities, I had missed a larger and more important human story. And so that's what I attempted to write with NeuroTribes.
All right, I have about 20 follow-up questions, but I want to get into just the interesting that the language that both of those parents used, I should tell you, I have an autistic son or daughter. Why do you think it's phrased that way, I should tell you? What do you think they were trying to convey with that?
Autism parenting has a long and terrible history of people being subjected to shame and stigma. Because for most of the 20th century, the prevailing theory among psychologists was that autism was caused by bad parenting. Of course, there was a guy named Bruno Bettelheim who was like America's first celebrity psychiatrist, and he wrote a bestseller in the 60s called The Empty Fortress, and he blamed autism on refrigerator mothers.
Right.
And so parents everywhere are still dealing with a lingering stigma of being blamed for their children's autism. And even now, the stigma sort of expresses itself differently, which is that many parents of autistic kids tell me that, you know, they'll be at the supermarket and, you know, they'll get a sour look from another mom who says, like, can't you control your own child? There's no question that some autistic behavior can be alarming to see from the outside if you're not used to it. Although I have to say, after spending a lot of time with these families and with autistic adults as well, I've pretty much gotten used to it. It's not that hard to get used to. You know, if a kid is having a meltdown, he's usually responding to something in the environment that's making him or her uncomfortable and that, you know, they should be listened to. But anyway, so I think that what they were telling me was that, you know, if you come to our house and our children are there, you may see things that you're not used to seeing.
There's a lot of talk among parents, especially parents of boys, that every child, it seems, is diagnosed with autism or ADHD or executive function disorder or sensory processing disorder. So many of these diagnoses, are these things becoming more prevalent or is it that we are recognizing them?
If you read my book, what it really is a kind of a 70 to 80 year history of how the diagnosis of autism has expanded, particularly in the last 25 years or so, or 30 years. One of the most frequently asked questions that comes to me is, do you think autism is being overdiagnosed? And, you know, aren't these kids just quirky? Well, I don't think so. Every person that I've met who has an official diagnosis, who's, you know, gone through the clinical process of getting a diagnosis, really does need special forms of support and help and accommodations just to get through daily life. I think that some of those disorders, parents now refer to their kids as alphabet kids because mm-hmm. they have so many, you know, acronymic diagnoses. You know, it's really well chronicled by the New York Times, I have to say, that ADHD kind of went wild with the help of Big Pharma. Big Pharma came up with drugs that they wanted to sell to the parents of kids with ADHD, and then, you know, miraculously, the, you know, ADHD diagnoses spiked. However, with autism, something else and very special is happening. What I describe is that Hans Asperger in the 1930s was the true discoverer of autism. And he believed that it was very, very common and that it was a lifelong condition that expressed itself in very diverse ways, from kids who couldn't talk at all to chatty professors of astronomy at universities. But then Hans Asperger had the misfortune of working in Nazi-occupied Vienna. And so his work was really not just forgotten, but buried after World War II by the guy who went on to claim credit for discovering autism, a child psychiatrist in America named Leo Kanner. And unlike Asperger, Leo Kanner proposed that autism was very, very rare, that it was an quote-unquote infantile disorder restricted to the early years of life. He once bragged that he turned 9 out of 10 kids referred to his office for a diagnosis of autism by other clinicians away without giving them one, because he was so concerned with keeping the diagnosis narrow, monolithic, you know, pure in his mind. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, I believe autism was radically underdiagnosed for decades, and often kids ended up with a diagnosis called childhood schizophrenia, which we now understand is very, very rare, but there were hundreds of kids in Bellevue diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. There were hundreds of kids at Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute, which is 3 blocks from my house here in San Francisco, diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. Childhood schizophrenia was considered an epidemic in the 1950s, which is like this eerie precursor of the alleged autism epidemic in the 80s. Now we understand that schizophrenia hardly ever manifests in childhood. And so what happened was, these kids were hiding behind different labels, mm-hmm. I would say. And so they weren't getting the help they need if they were, you know, if they could pass as merely quirky. They were pretty much left on their own, and their families were left on their own. And, you know, I chronicle many people who came into adulthood having no idea why they had such trouble with relationships and employment and just feeling comfortable in the social world, because there was no label for them until the Asperger syndrome label was invented in the 80s.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Asperger syndrome, because they just sort of got rid of that label.
Yeah, they did. They folded it into the autism spectrum disorder label. For me, you know, the saddest thing about that was the loss of the name Asperger, because I really feel that Asperger's work was very underappreciated and was very prescient. He really recognized that autism is a very broad spectrum, and he also developed ways to teach autistic kids and to support them throughout their lives. And so one of the things I'm very happy about in the book is that Asperger is one of the main characters, and he's a fascinating character, I have to say. And so at the same time that Asperger's name is being forgotten from the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, the DSM, I am remembering him at length in Neurotribes.
And a lot of his, the people who went by that diagnosis will call themselves Aspies and are fighting the fact that this has been taken from the DSM and still self-identifying in that way.
That's true. Well, Asperger syndrome was a very important invention culturally, because in America in particular, not so much in England, but England, by the way, has been about 30 years ahead of us on autism for a very long time. But for adults, the Asperger syndrome diagnosis was like the first diagnosis that could apply to them. And in part, it became popular because it didn't have the word autism in it. The diagnosis was invented by this woman named Lorna Wing, who recognized that Asperger had been right, that autism was a lifelong condition and that it was very broad and that it was very common, and that Connor had been wrong, that it was narrow, monolithic, and infantile. And she sort of behind the scenes swapped out Connor's criteria, which were very exclusive, from the DSM, and swapped in Asperger's criteria, and then coined this term Asperger syndrome, which she was quite frank in saying that it appealed to parents because it did not have the stigmatized word autism in it. And so it became wildly popular, and people started identifying themselves as Aspies, as you say. And that's something that, you know, I think Asperger himself would have been completely surprised by that.
Is the term now high-functioning autistic for the previously Asperger syndrome?
You know, I don't like the functioning labels, high-functioning and low-functioning. I'll tell you why. People who are called high-functioning are usually dealing with challenges in their lives that are not so obvious and that can be very disabling. And so high-functioning people are usually facing more intense struggles in day-to-day life than is obvious, whereas we're discovering, particularly as new technologies to enable communication for people who can't use words easily, spoken language, like keyboards, and to allow people who can't use spoken language to communicate, we're discovering that even so-called low-functioning people can be very, very bright and very adept and have a lot to say. Just because you can't talk doesn't mean you have nothing to say. And so I avoid the terms high functioning and low functioning in the book, although, you know, it's obvious that some autistic people are more blatantly disabled than others.
Yeah, I mean, one of the criticisms that you often hear about studies of autism is that they skew toward, I'm not sure what term to use instead of high functioning, so I'm going to use it for lack of another term, but they skew towards the more verbal, the more high functioning autistic end, because many of those who are nonverbal or may have other complicating factors or diagnoses at work are not even able to take part in the studies.
Yes, I actually spoke about this with Simon Baron Cohen, who is one of the pioneers of Asperger's syndrome research and autism research in England. And he described how gradually he noticed that the work of autism researchers was drifting towards, more articulate, more adept with spoken language people over time. And, you know, that's a kind of a natural thing in that experimenters simply found it easier to concoct experiments on people who could talk. Baron Cohen also expressed the notion that because it was believed that people who couldn't talk were suffering from intellectual disability, his colleagues, Baron Cohen's colleagues, thought that that was a complicating factor, and that by studying people with Asperger's syndrome, they were studying a kind of more pure form of autism. What's interesting is that parents in the United States often have the completely different approach and think that, you know, the purest form of autism is the most disabling. So it's an interesting question about how science gets done. You know, there's been much more research on so-called high-functioning people recently. I think that's a problem. One of the things that I really want my book to do is to get us to start thinking about where should the research money really go?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have spent millions and millions of dollars in the past decade alone, you know, what's often called combating autism. There was a Combating Autism Act. Where does that money go? That money usually goes on, sort of big-ticket fishing expeditions in human genetic databases looking for candidate genes that might contribute to autism. Well, we've been finding them. You know, we found more than 1,000 candidate genes that may in some way be involved with cases of autism.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that every autistic person is genetically unique. Even the most common genetic risk factors for autism are found in only a very small percentage of the cases. Okay, so then people say, all right, so forget about the genetics. Let's focus on environmental risk factors. Well, you know, so many potential environmental risk factors have been identified, everything from increasing paternal age to maternal smoking, maternal diabetes, Wi-Fi, said, Susan Greenfield in England. You know, some of them are more credible than others.
We won't even go into vaccines.
Yes. But what I would suggest is that we should be putting money towards improving the lives of the autistic people who are already here. So many of them, we don't even know how many there are. And a truly shocking fact that came out in a report from the Government Accountability, the GAO, a couple of months ago, was that the NIH funding for research on improving the lives of autistic adults has gone down in recent years. Keep in mind, there are more autistic adults than there are autistic children. It's so easy to associate autism with children, in part because Leo Kanner did for so many decades, but also because look at the websites of organizations like Autism Speaks. There are many, many pictures of children and few pictures of adults.
One thing I think is interesting is this new wave of universities sort of specializing in programs that are adapted for young autistic adults.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the whole generation of kids who were diagnosed in the 90s is coming of age, and we're recognizing that we have so few resources available to them, and that so much time was wasted, really, arguing about vaccines when we should have been building services for families and autistic people who could transition out of childhood into more rewarding, creative, and engaged lives.
It's one of the things that's I think makes it so hard for people to get a grasp on autism is that the definitions are constantly shifting, and the ways we're thinking about it have changed so much between getting rid of the diagnosis for Asperger's to thinking about it in terms of a spectrum. You've used the word condition, and I think a lot of people don't know, is it a condition? Is it a pathology? Is it a personality trait? Some people talk about it as extreme maleness. How do you see it?
I see it as a part of the human condition. And I think the profound truth that autism has to teach us is that some of humankind's most illustrious gifts are accompanied by profound disability. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is the many different ways that people with autistic traits in the past have contributed to the evolution of science, technology, and culture. By the way, I would say that the contribution of autistic women is still virtually invisible because there is still very little research done on women on the spectrum. And that's another area that we've been ignoring while we've been chasing down, the question, do antidepressants and the water supply cause autism? Why not research what the lives of autistic women are like and why they present differently on the spectrum than men? That's something we know very little about, and it's shocking. What Asperger believed was that the culture as we know it would not be what it is if it wasn't for the kind of hidden presence of autistic people, and he tried to make them visible. He did not identify it as only a pathology, as Leo Kanner primarily did. He looked at it as a mixed blessing, in a sense. It was a set of distinctive gifts that he called autistic intelligence, along with distinctive challenges, like the inability to read social signals in real time. And what he thought was that if society could accommodate the challenges, that autism would be less disabling, and then the gifts could shine forth and help us all as a society. And now that philosophy has been given a name by the daughter of an autistic woman, an anthropologist named Judy Singer. She coined the term neurodiversity in the 90s to celebrate the diversity of the styles of human cognition. That's what the word neurodiversity in my subtitle means. Instead of seeing conditions like autism and ADHD and dyslexia as errors of nature that must be fixed, we see those conditions as expressions of human genetic diversity that will increase the resilience and our ability to respond as a society to a very rapidly changing world.
Well, I think your book is going to go a long way in terms of shifting that focus in a productive and positive direction. So, Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Steve Silberman is the author of Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Alexandra Alter is here with news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on?
So this week, thousands of science fiction readers and writers are gathering in Spokane, Washington for the Hugo Awards, which are one of the most prestigious awards for science fiction writers, with past winners that include Kurt Vonnegut and Ursula Le Guin. But amid the celebration this year, there's sort of a controversy that's been brewing for the last couple of years, but it really blew up this year. The Hugo Awards are sort of an unusual prize because fans can vote, and it's sort of democratic that way. But there's been a block of writers who have been lobbying fans to vote for writers that they think should win. And there's sort of an ideological divide that has arisen around this.
What are the sides?
The very vocal group this year calls themselves the Sad Puppies, and they've run a very successful campaign to nominate these kind of swashbuckling, kind of throwback space opera type books that they feel like have been edged out in recent years in favor of more diverse voices, books by women, books that tackle kind of social issues and racial issues of injustice through the lens of science fiction. This group has complained that the awards have gotten too academic and too ideologically left-leaning. So in order to counter that and sort of take back the Hugo Awards, they have led this very successful campaign to nominate writers who are writing what they view as more traditional science fiction. Some really prominent authors have gotten involved in this fight. George R. R. Martin was blogging about it, saying that he feels like the awards are broken and need to be reevaluated.
Does that make him a sad puppy?
He is sad about it, but he is not a sad puppy. George R. R. Martin thinks what the sad puppies have done is it's not, you know, against the rules. It's in no way cheating, but it's making the science fiction community divide itself into two camps, people who support diversity and different kinds of voices and people who apparently are taking a more traditionalist view. And it's actually lining up on these right-wing, left-wing ideological lines.
But how political is science fiction generally?
I mean, that's an interesting thing. I think it's always been extremely political. It's always been a vehicle for writers to explore bigger ideas. I mean, going back to sort of futuristic dystopian classic works that looked at basically fascism and the effects of fascism through science fiction, it was a way for writers who were oppressed perhaps politically to write about what was going on in the world around them in a futuristic setting. And lately, it's actually become, I think, an even more interesting genre. There's a lot of works in translation that are thriving here, like a Chinese science fiction writer whose books are selling really well here, a science fiction writer from Cuba. And one of the most successful authors to emerge in recent years is Anne Leckie. Her book, Ancillary Justice, dominated the awards last year, won Hugos and Nebulas and other awards. And her book is very political. It takes place in a future world where gender is irrelevant and all the characters are referred to with the pronoun she. So these are the kind of books that the Sad Puppies say have gotten precedence over more traditional science fiction works.
All right, I got to ask. So if one side is called the Sad Puppies, what's the other side called?
I think it's everyone else, but I'm not sure. There hasn't been a formal block on the other side, you know, a group that it's named itself in any way.
Can we name them?
What do you think?
Well, I think it's obviously got to be something with kittens.
Something with happy.
Happy cats.
But the awards are concluding on Saturday. That's when they'll be given out. And after that, I think the whole organization is going to vote on whether the whole voting system needs to be overhauled to prevent this kind of stacking of the votes. So we'll see
how
it plays out.
Can we cue Twilight Zone music here?
I think we should.
All right. Well, we'll see what the future for science fiction holds. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Egan joins us now. She has a new novel, A Window Opens. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thanks for being here. So tell us about this novel. This is your first novel.
It is my first novel, and it is the story of a woman who finds herself on the brink of 40, starting a brand new job after her husband, in a very explosive fashion, loses his job. And she needs to earn more money, so she gets a job at a company called Scroll, which is supposed to be kind of the Starbucks of bookstores, with very carefully curated books for sale in a luxurious literary lounge, and it seems like the dream job.
Yes. Okay. I'm not going to be coy because you are the subject of a big profile in the New York Times this week because you worked at a Scroll-like company and you have also been a longtime player in the literary world. So just tell us a little bit about your background and where you've worked.
I was the books editor at Self for a long time and left there in 2012 to go work for Amazon's publishing division here in New York. It was a very small satellite office, and Amazon was and still is publishing its own fiction and nonfiction, but I was only working on fiction. I was only there for 13 months. For me, it just really was not the right fit. It was the wrong time of my life. It was the wrong corporate culture, really, for me. It made me start thinking about what one does when one finds themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time.
In the wrong story. Which is just like your heroine, Alice Pierce. When you were writing this heroine, Alice, how much did you think of it as being a kind of you once removed? And how like Alice are you?
I'm very much like Alice. I'm not quite as flaky as she is. It's a little embarrassing to me that people might think I'm exactly like her, but I also have three kids. I also live in New Jersey like Alice.
Is everyone going up to you and saying, oh my God, did your husband lose his job?
Yes, everybody is. And everybody says, does your husband have a drinking problem? Which he doesn't. I do have an unruly dog who is on Prozac. My kids are not happy that I've violated his privacy by going public about that. But yes, she tracks pretty closely to my life. But the events of the book didn't happen exactly as they do in the book. In the story, around the time that Alice starts working at Scroll, her father, who has had throat cancer before, has a recurrence and becomes very sick, which did happen in my real life, but not when I worked at Amazon.
One of the things I think readers will really relate to in this book is that it tracks two very different but major trends going on in so many of our lives. One is Alice is part of this sandwich generation right now, where she's dealing with caring for her parents at the same time that she is caring for her own children and for herself and her career. And kind of a lot of people have said this is, you know, the novel for the lean-in generation. But it really is true that it's about that juggle between competing family and personal agendas and needs. And then on the other hand, it's also very much of the moment in terms of what the corporate atmosphere is like in a lot of sort of high pressure, white collar jobs. Did you think about that consciously, or was that just all?
Not really. I mean, it's kind of the story of my life and my phase in life, and it's the conversation that I have with my friends. The thing that keeps me up at night the most is the pull between family and ambition and family and finances and trying to find the right, I really don't like the word balance, but trying to find really the right footing in both of those worlds. And right now I'm lucky enough to be working in an environment, I'm the books editor at Glamour. I find it a very family-friendly place to be, but not everybody is so lucky. And it made me think, what happens when you're in that spot and you have something in your life that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, that, you know, whether it's a sick parent or a spouse who's in their own career cyclone, or kids who need you more that year than they did the year before. It was a conversation I kept having in my own head and with my friends, and I felt like it wasn't really represented in fiction. We have all of these big nonfiction books. We have Lean In. Anne Marie Slaughter is coming out with a book in October about some of these issues also. But I felt in fiction, my experience wasn't really represented.
What's interesting, too, is that in this book, she loses her footing at home and she loses her footing at work. And all of these things kind of happen at once. And you think, well, that's, you know, improbable. But the truth is, it's not. That's the way things happen in life, where
absolutely
everything can pile on.
Yeah. When it rains, it pours. I mean, that's been my experience.
One of my favorite parts of the book is the specifics that you go into, especially in terms of language, with the corporate speak at Scroll. Give us an example of or a few examples of some of the ways in which they spoke in that office that didn't jive with a literary person like Alice Pierce.
There were many expressions I didn't understand. I mean, even the term metrics, even diving deep, looking at things from a 30,000-foot perspective.
Toggling.
Referring to books as carbon-based or...
Now, is that real?
Yeah, no, that is real. I will say that when I was at Amazon, everyone there has an excellent sense of humor about their own internal vocabulary. So, I mean, when I first started there, somebody sent me a glossary of all the terms that I would need to learn. So it wasn't like I was completely flailing and out there. But as a lover of language, it was truly like going to a different country and beginning again.
I want to ask you about an interesting decision you made as a writer in the book, where there's so much specifics true to life in the language, in the corporate atmosphere at Scroll. And Scroll, by the way, it seems like a completely believable technology company entity, a corporate entity. The brand names and in the sort of parenting foibles of today. But one area where you were a bit coy was with the town in New Jersey. Now, I know where you live in New Jersey. You invented a town in New Jersey, and I'm curious why you decided to do that.
Well, I'm a native of New Jersey. I am really perhaps New Jersey's biggest booster. I often think if my career in publishing doesn't work out, I might transition into real estate because I really, really love where I live. And I wanted to show that in the book and to show the way that in the end for Alice, the town and the people she lives with are, in my mind, the heroes and the mothers who are picking up her kids from school and cheering her on as she gets on the train for her first day of work, not literally cheering her on, but those are the people who kind of come to her rescue in the end. I've always lived in a small town and feel very, I love living near New York City, but I also have this passion for New Jersey that probably not many people have.
So that's the unsung part of your book. It's secretly an ode to suburban New Jersey.
It is. And the town is called Philemon because I grew up actually in South Orange, New Jersey, not far from where Thomas Edison's light bulbs were invented and from his labs. So I started thinking about the light bulb, and the filament is a key piece of the light bulb. So that's why I named the town Philemon.
So this is really a tell-all about South Orange, New Jersey. And life
well,
there.
I'm not living in South Orange now, but I'm living nearby.
All right. Elizabeth Egan, author of A Window Opens. Liz, thanks so much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you, Pamela. This was fun.
John Williams joins us now as the stand-in for our listeners. Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
So you're going to tell us questions that we've had from our tweeters, listeners.
We had a tweet question from a reader named Mike Stereznik, and he asks, would you consider sharing some of your fun regrets? I'm not sure fun is the word. He says, for example, the book review failed to note such and such amazing book, regrets distant, past, and recent.
So wow, can I name that? Only things that my predecessor did?
Yes.
No, I won't do that. although he is some of the best, but I was here, so I was culpable by association. and I don't know that these are all necessarily fun, but these are the ones that stand out to me. You know, I would say that there are always going to be books that we quote unquote miss because some books break late, some books may just not have appealed to the individual editor who looked at them. We always have some perfectly reasonable excuse, right, John?
But I would also say that we it's amazing how little we miss that breaks late. But it's
yes.
usually that something gains momentum after the fact, and then it's kind of too late to chime in.
Right. And certainly when the award, you know, nominees come out and the winners come out, it's not necessarily true that we have reviewed all of them or that we gave them all favorable reviews. A few books I remember that we did review a little bit late in recent memory, but I'll tell you why they were late but great. The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, that book we did not review right away. The editor who handled it, I originally skipped it. We did end up assigning it once we saw that it had gained readership.
Generated a lot of reaction.
It did generate a lot of reaction. And that actually enabled the reviewer at the time, Susan Dominus, to write a really smart review of the book because she not only was able to review the book, but she was able to write a broader essay about why it had struck such a chord and what the reactions were and what it meant. And it just turned it into a broader kind of cultural piece. Another regret was a printing error, I believe. But we did have a cover review written by Henry Kissinger, in which we accidentally left Henry Kissinger's name off the cover. It was not on purpose. It was an accident. There are no conspiracy theories there. And then I would say one oversight that did happen under my tenure was we did not review Thomas Piketty's book. I'm going to try to not over-French pronounce that that French pronunciation. One of the reasons we didn't review it ultimately was because so many people had written about it in the newspaper that I don't think people were really looking for another take on Thomas Piketty by the time his book actually came out. So I regret that we didn't review it in a certain way, but it would have felt redundant by the time a review had come in.
Yeah, and the paper certainly surrounded it in other ways, and there was a lot of conversation about it on other pages.
Right. So it was all very reasonable. I won't say that it was all necessarily fun, but there you have it. Mike Stereznik, I hope I answered your question.
Yes, and I hope that we don't miss many big things in the coming years.
All right. Ask us more questions. What are the coordinates, John?
The coordinates are on Twitter. You can follow us at NY Times Books and ask us questions there, or you can email us at books@nytimes.com.
All right. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
Our children's book editor, Maria Russo, joins us now. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Pamela.
So we have a big back-to-school issue, lots of children's books reviewed in this week's issue, both from picture books to graphic novels to regular novels to nonfiction to YA. Talk about some of the big books for the back-to-school season.
Well, our first review, I think, is one of the biggest books for this fall. It's a new novel by Rebecca Stead, who is the author of When You Reach Me, Newbery winner from a few years back. And we have a review, a wonderful review from Meg Wolitzer, who points out this is a book that is really in Rebecca Stead's sweet spot, which is 12-year-old children, 11, 12, 13-year-old children who are kind of on the threshold of becoming adolescents, but not quite there yet. And she really shows the emotional situation of these kids.
In other words, middle school.
Middle school, right. And even starting in fifth grade, I think for some kids. Her heroine is in seventh grade and has survived a near-death accident, a roller skating accident. She lives on the Upper West Side. And this is kind of about her coming back to life, really, and realizing that her friendships are changing, school is changing, her family is changing. And it's a quieter book, I think, than When You Reach Me, which had that time travel element that was sort of head spinning and exciting, but just as powerful, I think, as Meg Walter points out. It really is about change. And
another exciting name for that particular age group is, of course, Rick Riordan, author of the Percy Jackson series, et cetera, and who has his own book coming out, a new series, later this fall. But he writes a review of a new take on Robin Hood. What's that about?
Yeah, this is the start of a new series by Kekla Magoon about a girl who takes the name Robin Hoodlum. It's kind of set in a not quite real society where there's it's a totalitarian state. Her family is among the elite, but she's mixed race, so she experiences a lot of prejudice due to that. But she's eventually she's arrested on trumped up charges and becomes. Breaks out of jail and becomes a Robin Hood-like heroine interested in, redistribution, the income gap and equality. And so, Rick Riordan points out, we mythology for kids really has to capture the spirit of the times to work. And this book really does capture our current interest and passion right now for issues of social inequality and
budding social activists. Here you go. All right. What are the other big books for fall?
Well, I think we should mention the picture books. There's so many great picture books coming this fall, and we have three reviewed by Dan Saltzstein in this issue by really big picture book authors and artists. There's Waiting by Kevin Henkes.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Yeah, this is just a beautiful, wonderful book, and it's about waiting, which is, kind of a lesson in patience for children. It's about five toys that live on a windowsill, and they just wait. But his art is so graceful and elegant, and he makes children, I think, and adults see that waiting has its own beauty and fun, even.
Henkes is, of course, the author of Lily's Purple Plastic Purse, of the Penny and the Marble series.
Yeah, he writes kind of early chapter books and picture books, and they're all just beautiful and wise and funny, too.
He really gets that interplay between word and image, between the text and the image so well.
Yeah, he does. They're great.
One of the biggest hits from recent years was The Day the Crayons Quit in the picture book world. And it's got, of course, a sequel.
No, we have a sequel, The Day the Crayons Came Home. The crayons decide to,
they're
to
back.
Come back. And, I'm sure this one will do well, too. There's, you can't overestimate the incredible appeal and charm of Oliver Jeffers' artwork. I mean, it looks like just random crayon drawings by a kid, but they just capture so much personality and wit. But, our reviewer points out, there is something about this book that's in the category of books that seem to appeal more to parents than to children. The humor does seem a little bit over the head of a lot of kids, but somehow they keep selling. I think that maybe kids see their parents having so much fun reading these books that they kind of come along for the ride, too.
Let's talk for a second about early readers. One of the big bad news that's about to happen in the children's book world is that our beloved Mo Willems has decided that the next volume of Elephant and Piggy will be the last. For those of us who think that it just keeps getting more and more brilliant with each new book, this is very, very sad news indeed. But what it means is that a lot of publishers are coming up with new characters for early readers.
And, our reviewer, who is a school librarian, points out this is a hard category. Those early readers for children who are just starting to read on their own, it's a hard category to find variety in. And as you say, Mo Willems' books, Gerald and Piggy, the kind of neurotic, lovable friends, have dominated this category for a long time. And so now there's a lot of new ones coming on. It's hard to do these books. They're hard to write. It's a lot of production involved with making sure the words look right on the page and all of that. And so the new books that she points out that we have in this issue are one of them is by Bob Shea, who you might recognize from some of his picture books. He does the Dinosaur Versus series, so Dinosaur Versus Mom, Dinosaur Versus School. It's very different than Elephant and Piggy. These are much more antic and simple, kind of. Big bright colors and sort of slashing art.
One of the things I think that a lot of the new series have in common is humor. It's like
they're all really,
really
funny.
They finally got the lessons of Dr. Seuss and Mo Willems.
Dr. Seuss was the first person to really take this early reader category of book and say, you can do a lot there and make them fun to read. Kids learning how to read should be having fun. And I think the books that we have reviewed really do that. We have a new series called Pig in a Wig, which is really amusing. And I do want to point out we have a book called Flop to the Top in this review that is really in the comic style, which is a big trend and I think a really exciting trend for early readers, where it looks like comic style panels. And this can really help the new readers kind of follow the story. The one we have is about a girl who wants to be famous herself, and it turns out her dog becomes famous, and hilarity ensues.
Let's talk about one last comic book, since we love that genre so much, or graphic novel, but for readers a little bit older.
This one is it's called Secret Coders, also the beginning of a series by the brilliant Jean Luen Yang, who wrote American Born Chinese and the Boxers and Saints series. And he is doing here two things that are great, which is a middle grade book for readers that is very, very visual, for visual readers. It's also in the comics graphic novel style. And also a book that makes coding into something fun for kids. So it's a way to get kids interested in the basics of coding. So they're following, it's a mystery. It's two kids in a school where there's creepy things happening. And he very cleverly kind of works into the story coding principles about binary numbers. But it's fun.
Well, lots of great books here to read to your kids or to read over the shoulders of your kids. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks.
Carl Sagal joins us now to talk about the bestseller lists. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Pamela.
This week, you're going to talk about the combined list rather than the hardcover. So this is sales in hardcover and ebooks. What's new on the combined list?
Well, on fiction, there are a bunch of new books, if not names. We have Debbie McComber's latest, Silver Linings, which is her latest entry in her Rose Harbor Inn series, debuting at number 3. At number 10, there's, curiously enough, State of Fear by another mainstay, Michael Crichton, but this book was published in 2004. It feels oddly prescient now. There's a group of activists who start staging environmental disasters to prove that global warming is real. Also new on the list is Devil's Bridge by Linda Fairstein, the prosecutor-turned-mystery writer, and it's her 17th book in the series featuring Alexander Cooper, who in this book vanishes. And in nonfiction, which is a bit more steady this week, but again populated by some familiar names, there's Eric Larson, Mark Levin, Lauren Hillenbrand. But there is one new name who is totally new to me. Her name is Felicia Day. And her memoir, You're Never Weird on the Internet Almost, debuts at number 5.
I feel like you should know about this, Pearl.
I should. Well, she's now I'm kind of obsessed with her. She's fascinating. She was this, I mean, she's known to most sort of readers and viewers probably as an actress on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Supernatural, but she's, this pioneer and sort of renaissance woman of internet geek culture. She's called Queen of the Geeks. She was this homeschooled, woman growing up in Texas, and she became this violin prodigy, mathematical prodigy, and she also became obsessed with gaming and took a few cameras into her garage and started this show called The Guild, which is, beloved in online communities as the first sort of full-throated celebration of Greek culture. But, so she shopped it around. Nobody bought it. She put it up on YouTube, and she just became this huge hit. And she has this book now which sort of reads like online G-chat / riffs about, fandom and her own sort of very odd, dotty childhood and just like a celebration of obsessions.
See, people love books so much that they even want to read the internet in books. Anything else new on the list?
No, nothing else new on the list, but I hear we have some new developments in children's bestsellers.
We do. I will tell you about that. We made a big change this week with the children's bestseller list, and it sounds like a minor change, but the results are quite significant. Here's what we did. We had a middle grade list of bestsellers and a young adult list of bestsellers. And when we created those lists back in 2011, we decided that we would include all formats in each of those lists. So the middle grade list would be ebooks, paperback, and hardcover, all combined together, mm-hmm. and the YA books would similarly include books in all formats. The thinking behind this at the time felt very forward thinking, at least to me, since it was what I did, since I'm responsible, because people thought paperbacks were going to go away and that ebooks were going to take over and that the format of a book would become largely irrelevant. So I thought, well, let's just go one step ahead of that step ahead and we'll be there when book sales get there. Well, as it turns out, and we all know now, paperbacks have not gone away. Ebook sales have not eclipsed print sales. Mm-hmm. And hardcover really does remain the way in which a lot of new books get discovered. And our readers and authors and publishers made it known that they noticed, as we did, that a lot of the same books were on those lists forever. People used to joke that the YA list was the John Green list, and I love John Green as much as the next John Green lover does, but all of his books dominated because they were in paperback, mm-hmm. and teenagers like paperback, as do adults, and they were selling so much that they kind of eclipsed all of the new YA books that were coming out. So we backpedaled, and we said, okay, let's take middle grade hardcover and YA hardcover, and we'll run them here in the print New York Times Book Review. We will still count ebooks and we will still count paperback books. Those we will show every week still online, so we're not getting rid of them. But this is a way for people who want to see what's new and doing well in both middle grade and YA. And the results of this first list, I think, show that, in fact, there is a lot of exciting books for children being published, and they were not on the list before. So John Green, alas, though we love him, is no longer even on the young adult hardcover list. Our new number one best-selling YA author this week is Rainbow Rowell, author of Eleanor and Park, which John Green actually reviewed for us many years ago. So he's there in spirit. And on the middle grade hardcover, we do have a book that is has been out for quite some time, but it is a wonder. Sorry about that pun. R.J. Palacio's debut novel, Wonder, is number one. And there's also a lot of new titles, and that's exciting to see. So that will be in the weekly book review from now on, middle grade hardcover and young adult hardcover.
How exciting.
I think it's especially exciting to all these newly crowned number one best-selling authors, both on the list now and to come, and to the readers who will be discovering them.
And our apologies to John Green.
That's right. Sorry, John. All right. Thanks, Farl.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.